Phoenix FM. The voice of your community. 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Good morning and welcome to Real People Talk Autism. I'm Tony Langdon and I'll be hosting the show as Beck is unfortunately not able to make it this week. Before we go on with the show, a little bit about the station and the show. We're on Phoenix FM at www.phoenixfm.org.au where you can hit the Listen Live link on the top right of the page if you're out of the Bendigo area. Of course, we're broadcasting in Bendigo on 106.7 on your FM dial. And we have a Facebook page at Phoenix. Just look up Phoenix FM and you should be able to find the Facebook page. Also, the show has its own Facebook page. Look up Real People Talk Autism on Facebook and you can find us there and like us. We have a Twitter feed at Talk Autism Radio Oz. I believe Beck's the expert on the Twitter stuff. And we do have a podcast. This show will be up on podcast probably later on today at realpeopleasd.podomatic.com. So we have a special show. We're going to recap some of the early shows. There are going to be two interviews. The first is an interview with four local autistic men. That's Stephen, Glenn, Mark and myself that Beck did in late 2012. And then following that will be an interview with Daniel Giles. These interviews were recorded over a 3-week period, but we've brought them all into the one show for you. I hope you enjoy, and here we go.
On to our show today. Now, today's show is focusing on adult males in the autism spectrum, and on Thursday I sat down with Tony, Glenn, Stephen and Mark to talk to them about living with ASD in our society. It became very apparent to me very, very quickly that my pre-prepared questions were not going to cut it, so I just threw them and just said, look, let's just chuck the recorder in the middle of the table and see what happens. And what did happen was absolutely magical. Speaking with these men gave me incredible insight as to what it is like living with ASD as an adult in this what I call crazy world, and some of the hardships, but also it was just very touching. It was a very touching interview and really funny as well. I was editing through some of the audio and I found it incredibly funny, and these guys are amazing. Now, originally I was going to do just like a half hour interview. Our interview actually went a lot longer than that. So what I've decided to do, and I hope this is okay with the guys if they're listening, is I'm actually going to split it into two interviews. So I'm going to play the first interview this week and then continue next week. The first interview this week is obviously about their lives and living with autism. And then next week we're going to dispel some of the myths surrounding autism in our society. So I started out by asking the four of them, what was the biggest hurdle you've overcome in your adult life? And as I said, I've edited together a package to play to you, and the package pretty much starts off where that question left off. So I hope you really enjoy this interview, and here it is.
Getting people to understand you have abilities in some areas which cause no complications, but maybe the simple, what you might, neurotypical might consider very simple, that might be a stumbling block, which if that can be, it's like with jobs, if put in management positions where I have to manage people, I can't do that. Unfortunately, that keeps you down at lower levels. The workplace cannot be adaptive to your. They acknowledge high skills, but to do the high-skilled work, you have to manage people, and if you can't manage people, sorry, you can't do the high-skilled work. Mm. It's getting society to recognise your abilities and not the things that might be a stumbling block.
So you guys are all employed?
I was, up until I had a two-year nasty bullying incident.
See, my show last week was about...
I witnessed that and then brought it all back and I got upset.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. That was good to hear.
It was a good, very good show.
Well, Margaret, yeah, she's wonderful, Margaret. She's actually going to offer to come up here and do social skills training, and she does drama teaching as well. And, yeah, it seems interesting.
After so many years of just... in some regards, you have to hide your Asperger's, and you tell HR. I was actually employed because I had Asperger's. The lady who interviewed me said, because I started exhibiting certain behaviours during the interview, and I got upset, and I said, look, I must tell you, I'm having a bit of a moment. I do have Asperger's syndrome. It's not normally a problem, but just a few things we might need to talk about. And the lady said, don't worry, my friend has Asperger's, so,
So do you think in this day and age it's actually, like, disclosure during interviews and things like that is a good thing?
It's been fine for me, and I readily admit I've been lucky and not had bad times in employment until this one person, with the aid of HR, was just torment for 2 years. So
terrible. I can't believe it's not happening.
Yeah, the biggest problem I find. Sort of work's been that one area that I've had some jobs on and off. I mean, I blocked out for a period of the better part of 15 years. Just the right people, you know, there's that one in a thousand, you know, business owners or managers, and I just happened to strike that one in a thousand just out of pure luck, no other reason.
Mm.
But a lot of them, no one understands the whole system. It's not just the workforce, but the entire system, education, everything, assumes that if you're good at X, you're also good at Y.
Yeah.
And Richard Eisenmayer explained it really well, that a typical person will have a skill curve that looks like a smooth, like a rounded hill, whereas ours looks more like, it's just chaotic. And if... I mean, in a lot of areas I do pretty well, but the executive function is the one area, and that basically rakes all those holes deeper. Mm. And I struck it when I was running my own business, and that's sort of what limited me in the end. And also now with study, I've struck that they don't get it, that... I know the theory, and some of the teachers know that I know the theory, and I can put a lot of it into practice, but I can't do the assessment in the way, because they like, some of them want to have it all done as homework, or as it's all done as you got to, like getting work experience, you've got a cold call, and they just don't get it.
No.
And almost, I think they're just putting it in the too hard basket. When I go back next week, it'll be another round of talk with the course coordinator.
See, and I think now with this, I mean, I don't know if you've looked into the NDIS. I mean, I rolled my eyes when I sort of saw this, because I thought to myself, how is this going to sort of affect adults living with autism? I mean, how is this sort of... this model that they're putting out there, and with the whole new Gonski system, it's not just applying to primary and secondary education, it's applying to university education too. Is that going to have a follow-through effect for disability in the uni sector, where there is more support there for people who are on the spectrum
Is this part of the Americanisation of the Australian system?
Well, this is what I'm looking at, because I'm looking at the American model that they've got
in place there. That's what they're trying to do.
And that's what they're trying to do.
Australians modelling it after, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. And it's not working over there.
No, America's the last place we want to look for role models.
We can't create our own role models. I mean, come on.
And this is...
Isn't that going to re-traumatise people? People have taken so long to get used to the term Asperger's, now they have to get used to the term high-functioning autistic.
I know, because this is what they're trying to get rid of with the new DSM. And from what I've heard, if Obama gets in, he's apparently going to, block this new DSM that they're trying to get through.
Well, that's what he says now.
This is what he says now. Mitt Romney, I saw a very interesting interview with him in regards to disability in general in America, and it was sort of like next question. You know, he doesn't even want to go there.
And too hard.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of people who are scared, but I think you see with this whole new scale that the government's trying to bring in with the Gonski review and with, you know, there's very little being said, you know. Like, it's like, this is an all-Australian thing, but I'm noticing so many similarities with the American schooling system. Are we going to have raffles like they do over there to get our kids into school? And, you know, to get into those places in those best schools, there's that raffle thing where you get the number out of it. Yeah.
Your kid's won the lottery, gets to go to a good school. That's not the way it should work.
Right. Hunger Games in 10 years.
Yes.
The DSM-5 might not even get up because it's shown to be a flawed document and a flawed process. And there's been a lot of accusations of some very bad things gone on, was it? The way the research was done.
Well, it's just one man, isn't it? It was just one man's opinion on what needs to be changed.
And how thoroughly researched was his opinion?
But there's a lot about it out there on various spectrum sites. So, and I'm not. But even don't get me started on autism speaks.
Sort of sad, isn't it? Because autism speaks. We won't even go there. I think. So do you guys have like any kind of love it? The T-shirt.
Going back to your original question.
Yeah.
One thing that I've discovered with being carer for Steve and with my own issues in life is basically you come across people in life from professionals that have been doing their professional job and well paid for it for decades, as well as down to the average individual, will actually go, yeah, I get it, I understand it. You're telling them all the symptoms, what goes on, you know, this affects this person this way neurologically and sensory this and blah, 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 to do with their Asperger's or whatever. And they don't even seem to take it on board. They don't listen. It's too hard to ask. They create a blockage wall. And this is professionals that you're dealing with, your GPs and stuff.
They go by their assumptions.
Yeah, and they go by the look of you or whatever. Yeah. They're going by these literally assumptions, unfounded.
I've been judged as a drug addict since I walked into a doctor's office for some reason.
This
Iranian psychiatrist woman in Melbourne. And because I was wearing a beanie and I had my beard and a big black coat on, the first question was, how violent are you? How many fights you get into? I've never landed a punch in my life. I'm one of the most passive people you probably ever meet. But because I had the beard and the beanie and everything, she just assumed I was a violent person because that's what she had grown up with.
It's the thing, ASD doesn't discriminate.
No.
People do.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is like with the whole NT and non-NT, is the non-N, but NTs literally are still discriminating to themselves and to everybody else. And that's the thing with ASD, it's a non-discriminatory condition, like any condition like cancer, it doesn't discriminate who's going to get it.
No, that's right.
So why do we still have to keep being these psychologically almost deformed things and create barriers all the time? Mm-hmm. We're supposed to be in a modern-day civilization.
It's like
in the 21st century, acting like middle ages still.
They give you a label that allows them to discriminate against you.
Well, because this is sort of getting on to the next thing that I wanted to talk about was, you know, like society's whole whole sort of outlook looked when it comes to autism spectrum disorder. They have this view still, after all the awareness that's been out there, that everyone on the autism spectrum's like Rain Man. Everyone... But it's also been noted too that he actually was apparently not autistic. They were trying to, they're trying to say now that he actually had Fragile X, but Fragile X is actually part of the DSM, so I'm just like, well, that is autism.
And in 10 years, some other person, a well-paid job with a so-called professional degree, will be coming up with some other new term to confuse everybody else again, because it suits their purpose.
Well,
at their
but
time.
I think everybody's got this idea about autism that everyone with autism is a genius. I still believe that everyone with autism is a genius. There is, I think that the mind, I know I look at my children and my daughter comes out with some things sometimes. I mean, from the age of 18 months, she's been able to tell you the name of every single dinosaur that's ever walked this earth and whether they were from the Triassic or Jurassic period and whether they were herbivores or carnivores. She's, her knowledge with dinosaurs is amazing. And she's now using that to learn other things. I have a 2.5-year-old who can count to 25 and can tell you the colour of every single colour. But these are all things that he learnt visually. And I think that society has this idea of that what autism is, you know. And, I mean, do people, when they meet you, automatically assume when they learn that you're on the spectrum that that you have these special skills and that you're able to, you know, count calendars or have these things. Do people usually do that? Do you have that kind of sort of...
I don't tell them.
No, I don't tend to.
It's
but then again, I mean, I didn't even find out about Asperger's until I was 36. Before that, I just lived with, I'm a social phobic and I've got depression and anxiety and everything else they labelled me with. But I just got on with those things.
I was like labelled by teachers in primary school as being autistic or dyslexic or this or that, and basically I was looking at them as a kid and actually thinking, what is wrong with you all? I actually still look at society and people in general and actually go, why are you creating all these dilemmas still? Why do I want to be a part of this so-called system or society that just craps on itself, that eats itself and vomits itself back out again? You know, of course, you have to be a part of it to survive and live in this world. Doesn't mean I have to enjoy it all the time or love it.
Meet it halfway, and if you're lucky enough to make a living out of what you can do or
that's where I'm really lucky with what... This is the thing about the living libraries that are ASD people. They have their niches, and they literally become nothing but an intense encyclopedia about that, and they will not stop it. Any detail, they want to keep pursuing and pursuing, like your daughter with the knowledge of dinosaurs. It's like that with me with geology and textiles and fashion. And like, I have my things that I'm brilliant at. Once you get me started on my tangents, that's it. And I've learned how to focus and refilter those rants. So it's not so like a lecture at people. And that's a part of the, you know, tuning into understanding that NTs can be overloaded by what we have to offer as people.
Person with Asperger's will tell you everything you didn't want to know.
That's right. Maybe not, because you're not ready to handle some of that information. It's great, the information is.
Another Asperger will want to know.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
If you can figure out a way to have a field of stable neutrinos... Neutrinos probably go just a fraction faster than the speed of light, which means light passing through a neutrino, then neutrino won't be seen. And if we can get a field of stable neutrinos in a shell around an object,
we can make a thing go faster than the speed of light.
The light won't go through, so the object will be invisible. So then you have a Romulan cloaking device.
I love it.
We have to think about how they have a field.
Your artwork that you do, Stephen, is that a form of sort of
therapy
for yourself?
Like,
it helps calm you? Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Wow.
If I could see that as a career, I'd be a little better than a songwriter.
Really? Yeah. I look at your artwork and I'm just like...
I mean, too.
It takes
I don't get where it comes from half the time.
And it just
because I believe those people. you know. But it wasn't until I'd had a couple of nervous breakdowns as a chef, and I was sitting at home and thought, I just can't sit here and do nothing. And I started doing pointillism, the fine dot work.
Mm.
And I started to think some of the faces came out and was like, ooh, well, and I'm onto something here. I've got something in here. Mm. And it's taken me 20 years to pursue that.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah,
instead of being a square pear punched into a round hole.
Yeah. Because, I mean.
And I taught myself basically the whole lot. Because they weren't teaching me right. That's what I figured out. They were trying to teach me in the traditional methods, whereas I don't fit in those methods. I learn different ways. I prefer to sit back and watch somebody else doing it and pick it up that way than have somebody sitting there trying to lecture me how to do something. I can't pick it up that way.
Yeah, see, we're like that with our child. With our children, we allow them to just go with it. We don't. We make sure that she's holding the pencil properly.
Yeah.
But after that, she'll just go with it. Whatever she wants to do.
Probably in our standards, in the Western ways like that, but then we go over to Asia and they hold things differently again.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, you could have this child that's actually wanting to write like they're using a Chinese calligraphy brush.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
The past life.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Because that's what I wonder. Has autism actually always been around? And so now it's actually been considered a disorder. Before that, families helped people and people found their skill and actually managed to find a life through that.
The funny auntie or the funny uncle people would have had, back in the 30s and 40s.
And now people invented the wheel. They went in a corner and did it quietly, made the wheel while everyone was off socialising.
Yeah, banging each other there.
I do have that theory in years gone by, when society wasn't so homogenous, but we're made homogenous by the media and its influence.
We were called that.
Mass communication.
Mm.
Whereas in the past, society was more tribal or village oriented, and you always had the small number in the village that stuck to themselves. They were probably a bit loners, the tinkerers in the back shed, the inventors, and a lot of those were probably on the spectrum. If you're able to send a psychologist back to diagnose them in time,
put into monasteries,
a lot of those people who actually drove progress could well have been on the spectrum for all we know.
I read this really interesting article, I can't for the life of me remember where I read it, where they were actually talking about all the leaders, like tribal leaders, like the witch doctors from all third world countries like Africa, and are more than likely on the autism spectrum because they look at the world in a very different way, and that their views when it comes to other tribe members and looking at, that's why they have this special gift,
I think also the honesty fits in better with that natural belief system. I mean, your Christian dogma, your natural brain, I don't think you can get around that as well.
Yeah.
Whereas you're sitting down with something pagan or something.
Yeah, like the natural.
You can relate that a lot more, I think.
It's fascinating.
Right, and I've noticed with Aspies, this is quite a generalised comment, but a thing about geometry, they have a thing about their sensitivity to geometry and placement of things around them in their environment. It's a sensitivity factor. Like, I'm extremely what people would call anally retentive about stuff, particularly where it comes to the laying of my crystals and stuff. But that's the thing, it's like, literally, some people, when they're in a healing space like that, they'll notice a complete difference. They're busy meditating and enjoying it all, but when I've perfected it in my mind and placed them exactly the way I want, because I know the energy will function better, they feel it straight away. There's a difference, and that's actually me taking a neurotypical into my world. And that's the thing. We can, on a healing level, do it. And well, that's the thing, is that I've had huge responses to people in my healing sessions where I'm not about ego, I don't charge money, I don't do this. It's nothing about that to me. It's literally just about this is the possibilities and showing people a door. That's it. It's like, everybody's got access to that. Everybody's got access to the divine every day if they choose to. That's the thing. It's all about choice at the end of the day. And it's like, do you choose to keep putting up walls or do you keep finding doors to open and closing old windows and this and that, you know what I mean?
And NT processes whole walls.
Yeah.
They either pretend to go with and
they like you to fit in a box.
It's very tiring. It's so tiring to pretend to be neurotypical, but when you if you get into one unfortunate situation that I got into where became impossible to manage, and even to all the pretend mechanisms broke down.
Mm.
I broke down, and then you start to realise that, regardless of choices that you can make, or gifts, or talents, or abilities, at the end of the day, if NTs don't meet you halfway, you're going to have a very difficult, a very difficult life.
So you're finding that you're having to pretend to be neurotypical.
ASD.
Tom Cruise
is ASD. Dyslexic. Actors are drawn to, ASD people are drawn to acting in that field.
Yeah, I know Dan Aykroyd and Daryl Hannah have actually stated that, and there's that fantastic
Spielberg.
One
of the best ASDs out there. Really.
And then, you know, there's that amazing Dan Harmon. He's a writer and he wrote that, I think is a stroke of brilliance, is Community, a TV show called Community.
Mm.
Yeah.
Never watched that one.
He's an ASDI, and he, sadly, he's just been fired. The first three seasons, watch. Everything after that, don't go near it, because it'll all be written by Chevy Chase, and it'll be his view, what he thinks. But Dan created this show, and I followed his career, because he's brilliant. He's... The way this guy writes comedy is just, like, so left field. And it's things that you wouldn't necessarily find funny, like I would necessarily find funny, but I sat there and laughed my head off from beginning to end. And it's brilliant. It's just about a community college. And there's probably at least three characters in that show that I think he's modelled about himself. But the producers of the show had called him extremely difficult to work with. So they actually fired him from his own show that he writes and he created. And as he said, because being the ASDI he is, he came out in the press, all guns blazing. He said, pretty much I go into the office, sit in an office and sharpen pencils all day. That's my job.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a stroke of brilliance when it comes to, and I think that these amazing actors that you see out there are on the autism spectrum. Mm. It's just, why is there this huge thing where they won't actually say that they are? I know Keanu Reeves, there's been talk that Keanu Reeves is on the autism spectrum. Just recently, Kurt Cobain, they labelled him autistic because of all those gut problems he was having, that he was medicating with heroin.
Yeah. It's got to be something else.
So, I mean, obviously there are these high-profile people who are on the autism spectrum. Why are they not coming out and telling people? Because it's not something to be ashamed of.
It's not a good career move. Yeah. It's not a good career move. Like,
it's like it used to be.
Being gay is not a good
gay actor. It was just not done.
Yeah.
But now that's becoming easier than people,
Well, there's only one real actor who's the ease guy, and that's Rupert Everett.
Mm. Yeah, that's... the other one I'm trying
there's
to...
Zachary Quinto.
Neil Patrick Harris.
Zachary Quinto. The whole cliche suburban gay thing is like, we're blending into being the straight society, we've got a baby, and...
We've got
a
baby.
What's a gay actor acting as a straight guy for like that in that TV show? I don't understand it.
And also an overly sex lover of women, if you're trying to sort of say, I'm such a great actor, this is sort of...
Doesn't work on me.
Classic overcompensation.
It just looks like a closet case. He's making up for it by betting all these women.
Well, when I watch him on the Tony Awards, when he hosts the Tony Awards, I sit there and go, why are you trying to actually be so heterosexual? You know, embrace your homosexuality because that's who you are.
Yeah, and it's so obvious.
But let's go and adopt another baby. Now, look, I have a question too, because there's a lot of parents out there who have got kids and teenagers on the autism spectrum who have lots of questions. Obviously, they're worried about, sort of growth and maturity. Do you have any sort of anything that you want to say about how these parents could obviously maybe prepare their kids to go out and live in this kind of world? Like, is there anything that you did sort of through your teen years that sort of helped you, even with meltdowns, to help control meltdowns or something like that? Like, did you go into...
I just became a recluse.
You're supported in your reclusiveness because you have to develop these skills no matter what in life, and an overprotective parent's going to smother you and stop you from developing how you're going to anyway. Mm. It's going to happen no matter what. They're going to go out in the world and they're going to be teased. That happens to every kid. Mm. They're going to have successes. They're going to have failures. They're going to have, like any other person on the planet. They'll be different. Yeah.
So that even if they get cracked from outside, they've still got that foundation inside.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. The kids know that. It's a safe place to go back to.
Yeah, so it's a safe place.
I never felt like I had a safe place growing up. Mm. I had to create it.
Mm. Oh, I think we all did, but my case has probably got some benefit because I'm one of these people, like, being a recluse was not an option for me because it conflicts with my personality. I still like people, for better or for worse. There's still something about people that I do like. So I've just had to learn that, love myself.
Yes.
That's sort of one of the big ones. And B, just find things in life that calm you. Mm. Whether in my case it's exercise is a good calmer, hobbies and interests.
You've got a safe place to launch from.
And
you've got a safe place to launch back to.
Yeah, now I've got home as well. So that gives me somewhere safe. If I do want to get away from the world on those rare occasions, I can go home, and having a safe home is important.
Yes.
So it's a combination of having, as Mark said, having somewhere safe, and you've said that too, Steve, but also having outlets to deal with. I've also had to learn the lesson the hard way because the only partners I've had in life have all been very, very, unable to cope with, violence and outbursts, and so I've also had the motivation to have to do it too.
I hope you enjoyed the first part of our interview that I did with the boys on Thursday. I have to say it opened my eyes to a lot of things, and I'm truly grateful to them for being so open and honest. I mean, what else would I expect from four men living with Asperger's? So thank you so much for being so honest. And I have to tell you, next week, when we talk about dispelling the myths of autism, you're in for a real treat because it's just a brilliant piece of audio that people just can't miss.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Okay, so as I said, I interviewed the boys last week, and I've got part two of Tony, Glenn, Stephen and Mark's interview, which is where we discuss dispelling some of the myths involved with autism spectrum disorder and other issues. As you can hear, we actually got off track, but that's okay. It was great speaking to these guys. So here's part two of our interview with the boys last week. I hope you enjoy.
Girls have different core autistic symptoms to boys.
Don't know.
I've looked at quite a few different sorts, and sometimes you can actually see a female Aspie trait is like that male Aspie trait over there, and that male Aspie trait is like that female's Aspie trait. So there's differences, yeah.
Everybody's different at the end of the day.
There's similarities sometimes, but that's about it.
I think that's the bottom line. Everyone's different, and the women I've known and girls, I'm not sure the difference between male and female is necessarily greater than that between individuals.
Mm.
even the four of us are quite different in some ways.
Yeah. I think generally you assume nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This one's going to make you laugh.
I mean, just to dispel a myth further, how many Aspies do you know that are A, work in a team and B, play team sports?
Yeah.
We know one.
That'll be you.
Yeah. Not me.
All right, so another myth. People with ASD have no imagination.
Where do we start?
Where I got that one from? Autism Speaks website.
Well,
where do we start?
Contradiction in terms.
I used to write and publish science fiction stories and illustrate.
So, obviously, myth.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It depends on your quirk.
Yeah.
And I know there are some Aspies out there who are completely mentally orientated and probably don't give a hoot about creativity. Mm. But there's also Aspies like me out there who live and breathe.
Give us a mental image.
The only time I'm really happy is when I'm sitting with a paintbrush by myself in my room doing my thing.
I mean, obviously, with everything we've discussed today, obviously, I wanted to get that out there mainly because I wanted that laugh, because we've been talking about all these creative people who have created films and
things. Yeah, no, they're convention.
But that's the perception of creativity, though. I look at somebody who's doing, like, biochemistry or molecular biology or nuclear medicine and all that, and they're really going right into it and studying further and further. There is art in there. How can we just go, that's art and that's creativity, when science and this stuff isn't? And it is. It takes a certain type of creative mind to be attracted to it to begin with, and then to actually pursue and develop new medicines or new ways of looking at the body or whatever, from a scientific point of view. New travel.
Again, in my example, some of the radio stuff I've played with over the years, I've come up with some creative solutions to what were essentially people problems. We had two groups of people, those that like System A, those that like System B, and they said, no, we can't mix the two, it would just cause too much trouble. Mm-hmm. I did it, and now everyone loves it.
Mm. I kept getting told that you can't use oil and acrylic paints together. I do it all the time.
I kept getting told you should never wear blue and black together, but I still do it.
Yeah. I've been winning awards for my art ever since I was a kid. I basically could speak art before I could speak. I didn't want to speak for ages. Like, I taught myself how to swim by jumping in the deep end of a pool, which freaked everybody else out. But I learned how to swim by taking my breath underwater the whole length of an Olympic pool and jumping up the end and said, that makes more sense. I developed my own ways about stuff, and that's... everybody does, and that's creativity there, you know? We all don't go about brushing our teeth the same way.
Yeah, we call
that's
it...
that's the same thing.
We've got our own hacks. There's a worker...
borrowing from the programming... where a hacker is not what the media portray, but a hacker in the true sense is someone who takes something and does something new, experiments, you know, that explores systems.
I reject your reality and assert my own.
Yeah.
And that's the mindset of a hacker. All right, what can I make this computer do today?
But it's necessary because so often... I can't do it like that, but I can do it like this. If you let me do it like this, no one won't get hurt. Yeah. Mm. I won't get hurt, you won't get hurt.
But see, the swimming...
you'll probably benefit from
swimming was a good example for me. I went to about 3 or 4 or 5 blocks of swimming lessons as a primary school kid. Never worked. Couldn't teach me to swim for nuts. Mm. What did work was I watched the Olympics one year, and I sort of got a visual... image in my head of what they were doing, and I was able to turn that into what would I feel if I was doing it. And I thought, then I got in the pool, gave it a go, and going up and down, no problem. Mm.
All people on the spectrum never make eye contact. I mean, obviously, we're all
learning.
Never make eye contact.
Oh, some don't.
I had to learn very young that if I actually stare here.
Yeah, it's easier. Yeah. But I think that's society's problem too. I've always said that's a society problem. Yeah. That's the neurotypical, you know, if you don't make eye contact with someone, you're shifting.
Yeah.
Or you're not too trusted.
And if I think you don't hug, you're weird.
Yeah.
I've had that from my family for decades.
Yeah.
I don't hug, so I'm weird.
Yeah. But I mean, this is sort of something that we go through. I have a family member, when you say give me a kiss, he'll put his head down like that so you can kiss the top of the head.
So what makes you think I'm making eye contact anyway?
Well, this is the thing, you could be looking through me.
Yes.
You could be,
that gets back to that.
I think as I said, I think that's a society thing. Yeah. That's something that society...
But it's giving that person the impression that you are looking into their eyes.
Yeah. You know. And that's probably...
I mean, if we go back to tribal culture, to look in the eyes is actually... to make love or to fight. That's the only time. It's a spirit thing. It's actually a much more honouring thing. We actually, in the Western society, throw around so much energy and concepts and ways of living that actually it's kind of messy, you know, and any wonder we have a lot of the issues that we do.
I do, actually. If I meet someone and I feel it's... If it's going to be a continuing relationship, I will... I will explain some things, and the eye to, because I know, and I have to make a conscious effort to, and I don't like it.
Yeah, and it's hard.
I've been to doctors and just say to them, I've got asperges, and straight away they're looking at me.
Yeah,
just
waiting
like,
to
under
to
the microscope, and they're sitting there going, I'm not going to look at you, I'm going to look at the floor.
I could add the other one, don't start me in a staring contest, though. even the cats won't take me on then.
Yeah. So I will actually say...
I'll stare at
I might not make eye contact. You might say something and I might forget to make those sounds of... I am paying attention. I might not appear to be paying attention, but I'm taking it all.
But for me, I think eye contact, the way I understand, just understand my own language of eye contact, if you want to call it that, is it's all about connection. If I got a connection with the person, the more connection I got, the more eye contact I make.
And,
like partners, no problem at all. But people I'm comfortable with to some extent, a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, whereas the average person's straight, forget it.
Yeah.
But someone who I feel that there's something, and it doesn't take long to find that connection. With Mark, that connection took about 1 second, literally.
When we first met, you were looking over that way, I was looking over that way. It's funny when you even glimpsed each other, because we're conversing.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, you can be in that space and not be able to. I know that a lot of people who I've spoken to who are on the autism spectrum who don't like making eye contact have found it actually quite... It's an over-sensory thing for them.
Mm.
It's too much. It just becomes too much because they're trying to concentrate on a conversation that they're having with words coming out of the mouth, and to be able to maintain that eye contact, it's just too much.
Well, you get migraines at certain times if I look at you.
Yeah.
It actually sets off a migraine in him to the point where that's it, the whole night's ruined, you know?
Certain things can't deal with.
Yeah, but we've learned to curb that, and it's...
I have to sit there with a wet towel over my head, just...
Meeting people in a dark room is a good idea.
Yeah.
See,
probably not a bad thing.
I've trained the subconscious to deal with a lot of those overload issues in all sorts of ways, which I'm still trying to understand, because if I understand, I might be able to help some others.
Yeah.
Whether it's eye contact, it's only when you sort of point out, I realise that part of my mind had sort of shut down to, I'm in the right direction. That's why I said, how do you know I'm making eye contact and such? Because when I couldn't process, that part was just temporarily switched off.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the topic of driving comes up from time to time. I've actually turned peripheral vision into an asset. Because the way I was taught to drive, and probably everyone else was that you have to actively look out for, for anything that might cause trouble, for danger.
Yeah.
For me, that's a tiring process. In computer programming, the term for that is polling, and it's, computer programming, and for me, it's considered very, very intense on processing. And it doesn't really work for me. But I've got the ability that anything that moves in peripheral vision, instead of generating that panic response, is more, gets my attention. It's like there's something that needs to be looked at, and it'll just suddenly pop into my attention, and I'll see what it is, and I can deal with it straight away.
Mm.
And if I knew how I've done that, it might help others.
What annoys you most about the latest research into autism spectrum disorders
It comes from older fathers or immunizations or, you know, anything related to diagnosis and the spike in diagnosis that we're seeing right now in our society.
What's really annoying is they go, it stems from the father, it comes from the father, and it's actually, I'm finding it actually comes from the mother more. It's not something to blame.
No.
But my mum is definitely on the spectrum, and her mum definitely is on the spectrum.
Yeah.
And us three kids are on the spectrum. And I do remember being very different as a kid, and my brother always being very behind, even, he's much older than me, 7 years, 7 days older, and my sister always talking with facial twitches and that, to the point people don't know what's going on and make jokes of it and that. And it's actually, it's a neurological condition. It's mild Tourette's, you know, it's how it's affected her. And then I remember as a kid, we were going to Malaysia, I got vaccinated, and I remember the doctor sticking this massive needle in my arm for these vaccinations to go overseas with, and I had to watch him, and he's like, this is the first time I've ever seen a child not scream and cry about it. And I said, I want to make sure, I'm almost said, documenting what you're doing to me. That night, all of a sudden the world started spinning and I fell out of my high chair, knocked myself out, and the world hasn't stopped spinning since. And I think that's actually increased my ASD or whatever. It's actually made life difficult. Sometimes it feels like I'm in this sticky, weird body. I can't fully control it properly and it's not my fault. And you get judged on it because you're trying to just struggle through some days.
Yeah.
That's why some days, no, I'm not leaving the house because I don't want to have to put up with people's projection. And that's the thing, I'm really tired of people projecting their insecurities and their this and that and their judgments and everything.
I get comments in the street. I had to tell my doctor I really have to, I'm worried about being arrested because there were kids making comments about me and I chased them. What I would have done if I'd caught them, I don't know. But I thought, this has got to stop.
I mean, I've been bullied since day one, basically, by my brother and that, you know. He was feeling insecure with himself about his own conditions and that, obviously, and just took that out of me. And you basically don't stop being the scratching post for some people who are obviously being bullied at home or having hard times and this and that because you're an easy target. And, yeah, you can take it on board. I got very depressed to the point I ended up in hospital a few times from suicide attempts to the point of kidney failure and being in a coma. But I learned how to walk again, my kidneys started functioning again, and I got over my drug addictions because of not feeling worthy and thinking that the only way you can make do and act human is on an amphetamine or something like that to help release what's hidden inside. And that's when I discovered a bit of, I can be more than what I am, I don't have to hide away through drugs, unfortunately, that's how it was. And sometimes we call it drugs, but nowadays, in doctors' terms, we call it medicating, don't we? I realise I've been self-medicating a lot during my life.
It's the only difference between illicit drugs and medication is one's legal and the other's not.
I mean, what do you feel about medication being used?
For certain things, it can be a sticking plaster. It can have its purpose, or it can really stop people from healing properly.
I think it has a place. I do think it's overused, although I will say I actually have never had any medication for anything related myself, but I think there is a place for it. But
depends on why it's been.
Yeah, exactly.
I was drugged from age 3 till I was about 13, and I left home at 15, escaped. And but that was just to shut me up and get me out of the way. My parents did that to me. Doctors obliged them. This is in the 60s. There was no support. This is what happens to people when there is no safe place. There is no support.
Drag them up.
That's
why.
That's happening.
What they want to do. And institutionalized.
It's not me.
So it's like, you know, because I'm noticing this
huge thing that's going through society now with all of these kids who are being diagnosed, where parents are using melatonin to help them sleep and where parents are then using things like, you know, antipsychotic drugs on their kids. I watched a really amazing doco on... with Louis Theroux.
He's cool.
Did you see the America's the Medicated Children episode?
No, I haven't seen that one.
I'll send you the link to it.
Yeah, no, he rocks. He's just so...
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, they're pumping these medications through these kids. I mean, these kids are having enough drugs in their system to kill a bloody ox. But...
Is this America?
And
America's intervention into Africa is also to experiment pharmaceutically on the people of Africa for different pharmaceutical reasons. They do it to their own American people, particularly the poor, that can't afford the true medical system. So, here, we'll give you, put you on this special program and you get free medicines.
Yeah.
And they're nothing but guinea pigs.
Yeah.
Causing
all
these
effects. Well, I'll send you because it'll really open your eyes. You've just got... Because one of the kids has Asperger's and he's... You know, he also has ADHD, he has all these little comorbid conditions that go along with it. But then he also is clinically depressed.
Mm-hmm.
He's 9. Yeah. And they're dosing this kid up with so much.
They're creating a neurochemical monster later in life.
Well, this is what Louis pretty much approaches it and says to her, you know, aren't you worried the fact that these drugs haven't been tested on children under the age of 16, you're giving it to your 9-year-old in huge doses. Mm-hmm. Don't you worry about what those side effects are? And the mother looks at him as if he's stupid.
Yeah.
And I just sat there going, oh my God, this is like this recipe for disaster.
But the American system of education is actually, they're like that in general.
A lot of that calming effect, a walk in the bush will give a lot of us the same effect. Something where there's light exercise and nature will just as well.
I've had sleep patterns since I was 12 months old, according to my mother. Mm. And all I've done is learnt to do my hana. Yeah. Any time of the day or night when I can, I don't have to worry so much about it.
You're not going to
take this to help me sleep.
If you're not harassed in
I can just do it in my own body's time.
Yeah,
or the creativity or whatever was at night time, and the work became at night time as well.
Mm-hmm.
And late afternoons into the evening. And, but I had, but when I got day work, it was a huge struggle, and it was like another world for me to adapt to. And I thought, I don't really want to go back to being a nighttime person, so I stay on a specific regime of because I used to also get up like 4:30 a.m. in the morning or 5:30 a.m. to go off to work. So. I don't know if I'll ever work again. I hope so. I still maintain going to bed at 9:30 or 10 o'clock.
And that you reprogrammed yourself to be able to get yourself into that?
That was back when I was... I'm 51, so this is back in the... back in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
Early 80s, sorry. When I started doing more full-time work, and stopped being a night person, but it was like a different planet.
It was the best for me.
That's what I did.
I found myself when I had to work during the day. It was weird to me.
But now Mark's got me, of course. Now, he's not a night person, I'm the opposite extreme in that. My body clock is, Aspie's traditionally known for having a body clock that just does what it likes. Mine's the opposite. It does whatever the sun does. And I discovered when I went to the States, it's so extreme that I can adjust a jet lag with just an extra little bit of sleep in the night. And next morning, because when I went over to the States, The night I got there, all of us that were there said, oh, we won't make any plans for tomorrow because you won't know what you're going to be like. I said, I've never done this before, so I don't have a clue. I could be fine. I could be jet lagged for the rest of the week.
Yeah.
I just had no idea. Anyway, I went to bed at 10 or 11 o'clock, which is their local time, which is about the same as I normally do local time here. And the only difference was, instead of waking up at 6 or 7, I woke up at about 9. Got straight out of bed, stuck my head out the door, said, "Okay, guys, what are we doing? I'm fine." Bang, just like that. And I didn't have any symptom of jet lag whatsoever. It was just that, like that extra correction. There I was right. But if I try and do that and keep odd hours and stay in the one place, forget it, I'm trash for the next day.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
Now, I have one more myth here, but I think we sort of covered it anyway, that bad parenting causes autism. It's such a 1950s, but obviously that myth is still out there, because I will let you in on something. A lot of the parents that I've been dealing with, there is a paediatrician in this town who is actually overturning diagnoses that have already been given to these families, saying that, no, it's not autism, it's bad parenting. I've seen it in writing on three different... assessments that this doctor
nothing
has done.
To do with
that's that. Hilarious.
Oh,
really,
and
hilarious.
The fact that we've got a paediatrician here in town that's still using the whole bad parenting.
It'd be funny if it wasn't so serious. Yeah.
I know, that's the thing. I mean, it would be funny if it wasn't serious, but as a result, I mean, we went to an early days workshop and I met some families who have now gotten a late diagnosis where kids are like 8 or 9 years old and are being diagnosed when they could have actually been diagnosed back when their parents first took them to this doctor. And
just because they're a doctor doesn't mean they're good, doesn't mean they're God, doesn't mean they're a good or bad person. They're just a doctor and they're infallible like the rest of us. Doctors are known for lately not even looking at your results on screens, not even for looking at past allergens and prescribing penicillin to people that are allergic to antibiotics.
Well, my doctor,
so you have to check on your doctor no matter what. You check on your doctor or whoever's taking care of your medicine. It's your body. You've got to take control of yourself.
Yeah, because this whole bad parenting thing has obviously been around since back in the day. You know, the mother was ice cold, so the child has a developmental problem because of it, or behavioural problem.
Yeah, no, that's just hogwash.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Any parent, just don't listen to that.
And you've also got to think about it, you know, when you're reversing an already diagnosed child, that's not giving them access to any funding. It's not giving them for any of those therapies that these parents might not be able to afford. I know with, you know, a lot of situations where families, especially here in Bendigo, there is already limited services. So to be able to access funding to be able to take that somewhere else, like get something that their kids see in Melbourne, but for this guy to be doing this, it's criminal. I named him on Facebook, but then I had to take it down. That's the problem, that I do know this guy is poison. He's absolute poison for ASD.
Twitter's probably the place.
Yeah, that's probably the best place for it too.
But also it goes back to people have got to just take personal responsibility for themselves and their family. You can't keep putting trust in other people. As much as they've got a degree or whatever behind their name, you have to check up on your GP. You have to check up on your psych. You can't fully trust anybody in society, so why would you fully trust your GP?
Well, this is the thing, and I think if there's parents out there who are being told this, they need to realise they're not bad parents, because the fact that they're taking their child to see someone is obviously means that they care about their child. Yeah. So, you know, don't listen to what these people are telling you.
More bad doctor than bad parents.
Yeah.
There's a lot more bad doctors than bad parents.
So parent just wants to hear, well, okay, maybe it's diet, maybe we'll look
at it. I mean, really, when you think of it, how many GPs can keep up with the amount of stuff that's being discovered and altered and all the time? They'd have to be sitting there reading books all day. They wouldn't actually have any patience.
I just get this feeling too that they're not actually like going on and doing education. I mean, I think that there needs to be like
this thing where these doctors who are, they're going to have to continually educate themselves.
Yes, that's right.
Don't just go off and do your degree 30 years ago and think that you know it all and you don't need to do it.
Oh, well, it's part of being a doctor. They have to maintain their intelligence and integrity.
That's exactly.
Otherwise, I've got no respect for
them. That's exactly the thing I had when I was in IT. You just had to keep up to date all the time because...
develops.
Yeah, and like medicine, it's another industry that's constantly evolving.
Some kind of need, and outside us rolls the bus, and the time will go by till inside me I am asleep. Then roll bus, roll.
I hope you enjoyed part two of my interview with the boys. They are very opinionated, but I think they make some very valid points when it comes to living in this world, in this very neurotypical world. I actually had somebody ask me last week with some of the things that were stated, what are NTs? Oh, I was just like, well, okay, well, it is actually a term called neurotypical, which, for those of you who don't understand what neurotypical means, it's people who don't have autism. So that's what NT means, just in case, you were still wondering. So, I'm actually a little bit sad that interview's ended, because I found the boys such an absolute pleasure to sit down and talk with. And as I said last week, and I'm saying again this week, I'm so grateful to them for taking the time to come in and inform everybody about their views of what it's like to live in this world.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. We'll be back in a moment with the interview with Daniel Giles. But in the meantime, here's Tinchy Strider with Number One.
Think it's games, kiss chase, just a quick fling. Now I'm hoping you never go missing. Now I'm telling you, you can hold this ring. Watch how it glistens. Thought it was done as quick as the wind blows. Didn't think I would ever be involved. So I even read a song called Don't Go. Now it's just you and me on a love road. We're running like D-Lo, us two tiptoes, that dive get low. And now I care less about who knows. Now we're deep in way past intro, that be explained though.
See, never did I think a boy like me would be in need when all I really wanted was to have some fun.
No, I'm
telling you one thing, you're number one. See, I don't understand how you're number one when it was just a fling before. Now you're the one. See, all I did was blink twice from my homie to my only number one.
Yo, yeah, it was all now, never planned no after. It was like games, jokes, laughter. Live for the moment, left it all open. Now I'm in deep flames, lava, breathe, karma. And now I'm stating, see, I never saw this in my daydream. It's really you that I'm fully rating. And the day's here, no more waiting. Played it all ass with a smart man raised him. I was all hurt, pain, aching. On the wrong path, then a good girl saved him. That's why I'm letting her know she's amazing.
See, never did I think a boy like me would be in need when all I really wanted was to have some fun.
No, I'm
telling you one thing, you're number one. See, I don't understand how you're number one when it was just a fling before. Now you're the one. See, all I did was blink twice from my homie to my only number one.
You lift me off the ground. I always want you around. I ain't gonna let nothing get in the way. I'll never let nothing get in the way. You lift me off the ground. I always want you around. I ain't gonna let nothing get in the way. I'll never let nothing get in the way. I ain't gonna let nothing get in the way. You play your cards all right, you're an ace. You make my nights so bright, you're my days. You took me out of the maze.
You are number one. I don't understand how you're number one when it was just a fling before. Now you're the one. All I did was blink twice from my homie to my only number one. You lift me up ground. I always want you around. I ain't gonna let nothing get in the way. Won't ever let nothing get in the way. You lift me off the ground.
You're a leader. Girl, you're out of this world, they can't see ya. And now you got a place in my heart. It's funny how you actually went from my homie to my only number one.
The voice of your community, 106.7 Phoenix FM.
Okay, so now I've actually got another interview. As I said, I spoke with Daniel Giles this week. Now, Daniel's a local man who lives in Bendigo. He's a man living with autism, and he's constantly bringing awareness to the area through conferences and talks, as well as through his church group, which you'll hear. Now, obviously, this is actually now part one of two interviews, and I will continue on with his interview next week, in next week's show. And I started out by asking Daniel about his educational experience at La Trobe University. I think people will actually be quite astounded by this man. He's a very intelligent man who has a lot to say, and I hope everybody enjoys my interview with Daniel Giles.
You went to La Trobe. What did you study at La Trobe?
I studied graphic design.
And that's now, you finished that degree a couple of years ago?
Last year.
When were you diagnosed?
I was actually diagnosed at the age of 2.5 years, which was pretty early, considering that back in the 1990s, when I was a toddler, there wasn't the same awareness of autism as there is now. And I was also more severely affected in that I virtually had no communication.
You're doing really well for yourself. You mean, you've finished uni, you've got your own place, you have your own website, and your own graphic design business, is that right? You do graphic design, or you do innovative design?
Yes, I've actually just got a couple of job offers in Melbourne that will be part-time, and I'd probably only simply stay with someone a couple of days a week and contribute to their living expenses. But I found, to be honest, the freelancing quite difficult because of all the trying to chase up clients, manage bills, and
that'd be hard. Do you believe in disclosure? So with these job offers, when did they come to you? Did they approach you with work?
Yeah, well, one of them's for Alpha Autism, which provides services to, including an employment service to adults with autism. And the other job offers, a graphic design business that specialises in accessible communication for people with disabilities. I would find, though, that most of the big graphic design firms would not be autism-friendly at all. And they'd be like about, they'd be about basically, I question whether they would like to take the time to understand autism. And the ironic thing is, graphic design is a It's like, it seemed the type of industry to fashion design, even though I'm personally not into the latest trends as much as I like to look good.
You look fantastic.
In what I wear, but then, yeah, going back to, I remember one experience 6 years ago where I was on work experience during secondary school, and one of the supervisors presumed I had an intellectual disability, or probably in his mind he might have even thought further than thought I was intellectually disabled because of my slow monotone voice, and he told me that I should have done it for a disability service provider, he shall not be named. And I was deeply offended by that attitude.
So, Daniel, these jobs that you've been offered, are these going to be full-time positions? Are you planning on going into full-time work, or are you planning on just working part-time?
I'm not planning to go into full-time work simply because I'd have to probably live in Melbourne full-time, which I do not want to do yet, considering I've got a great flat in Bendigo and would struggle to find a flat like the one I'm living in elsewhere. And secondly, I'd like to have time to pursue my other passion for public speaking, to spread the awareness of autism, plus also time to, I work with CBM, which is formerly known as Christian Blind Mission, to spread the awareness of disability inclusion to churches.
Going back to your childhood, you went to mainstream school? You went into a mainstream schooling system, or...?
I started at the Bendigo Special Developmental School because at the age of 5, my IQ could not be measured. I think I was classified as having an intellectual disability, but Dad said he knew there was more than that.
Yeah, you showed them.
Yes, and my family pushed for me to enter mainstream education, and with the support of a wonderful integration aid, he did not babysit me or basically do the work for me, but she basically taught me how to learn independently, and in the process her goal was to make herself redundant.
Yeah, such that you didn't need her.
No, yeah. Or not in the later years of school anyway. But yeah, I had a dual moment between the Bendigo SDS and Quarry Hill Primary School for a while, which basically meant that I spent some days awake at the SDS and some days awake at the mainstream school, which my time at the mainstream school gradually increased until in the middle of grade 5 I graduated from the SDS and attended the mainstream school full time.
Yeah.
Now I then completed my secondary education at Catholic College Bendigo, and that was another wonderful experience. Especially, I mean, there was bullying and what have you, but overall, the staff and the students were welcoming and accepting towards me.
Yeah.
And I was even encouraged to participate in leadership and extracurricular programs.
That's brilliant. I think school, I don't, what do you think? Do you think that your experiences at school have helped you now be the person that you are?
Definitely.
Yeah. And was there any one person that you could sort of, that sticks out in your mind as the person who inspired you to go on into uni and things like that?
I think I'd have, say, 5 or 6 teachers in, or a couple of teachers at the special school. He was very creative in me reaching my full potential. And he genuinely supported me moving to a mainstream school.
That's a huge thing.
And then secondly, there was one particular teacher in grade 6 that really encouraged me, like especially when I made mistakes, or even I remember one time we were doing phys ed on the school's oval, which was actually a square playing field, and I said to my grade 6 teacher, why is it called an oval when it's a rectangular playing field? And he explained to me that I took things literally. Then there were a handful of teachers, including one that I had in year 8, and he was particularly for students who struggled at school, like he, most other teachers would have simply yelled at them and said, what, you're getting detention at 3 p.m. this afternoon. This teacher worked with them, and I felt a time when I had him in the classroom. Then I have a teacher who taught me for visual communication and multimedia in year 11 and 12, as well as being involved in the running of a leadership program I was involved in, and he was also my homeroom teacher in year 12. He was one of my biggest supports during phase CA.
Do you know what your triggers are that might set off an anxiety sort of moment for you? I hope this isn't making you anxious.
I think...
I can have very perfectionist standards. Even in my behaviour and... Or even admit that with my faith, I don't believe I can be obsessed about that, but sometimes I get obsessed with whether I'm doing the right thing or not, which I realise that I personally need to realise that I'm going to make mistakes and that I'm doing the best I can. So sometimes, to be perfectly honest, I get so worked up when I make a mistake.
Yeah.
And that's one of my biggest triggers for a meltdown.
Yeah.
And that was Daniel Giles with the first part of his interview.
106.7 Phoenix FM.
I am actually now going to present you with the second part of Daniel's interview, and I hope you enjoy it. It's actually very beautiful, quite poignant at times, and answers some tough questions that I posed to him. Now, I started off by asking him about public speaking and how he would feel about actually speaking to a grand scale audience in public, and you'll be surprised with his response. So enjoy the second part to the interview with Daniel Giles.
Have you done any sort of training in regards to getting up there? And I mean, because I know that there'd be a lot of people who'd be interested in listening to you and listening to your story. Would that make you feel anxious if you had to stand up in front of 150, 200 people to talk?
I've done it for years.
Oh, have you? Oh.
To schools, university and school students.
Have you thought about putting a submission in for the big conference next year in Adelaide?
Amanda Golding's thinking of me co-presenting with someone else. An autism conference is not complete without the input of people on the spectrum themselves. Mm. Like, I admire the knowledge of the people working with autism, but people with autism, but I think it's usually the individuals and the families that are the real experts.
Well, I think I was once told, what did they say? Oh, well, you know, you're just a mother of children with autism.
Mm.
But within 3 months of diagnosis, you actually have a PhD in it because you live with it every day. You know who your kids are. And so I know the support that I will give my children until the day I leave this earth will be unabated. But I'm not going to smother them. Were you sort of, obviously it sounds to me like you had a very independent education.
Yeah.
And that, do you think that helped you, like with your family, did that help you prepare you for life when you moved out?
Yeah, my family were thankfully very much, I mean, sometimes it does get a bit stressful because I don't believe you can push someone to pretend to be a neurotypical. Like, I'd rather not be be someone or I'm not. But I do appreciate however my family and many other people helping me reach my full potential, manage living with autism, and like obviously I have to live in a, I can't just expect the world to be an autism friendly world. And I like to challenge myself to be in situations that are not autism friendly.
Because I was posed a really interesting question the other day. Someone said to me, if a magical pill were created that cured your children's autism, would you give it to them? Would you take it if they...
No.
Because your autism... I mean, obviously, you don't allow your autism to define who you are, but in a way it sort of does too, because you wouldn't be Daniel Giles if you didn't have your autism. This is what makes you uniquely special, and this is what's put your amazing stamp on this world. So you wouldn't even consider the thought? Not at all? You would never take it?
Instead. I would like it to be... I do wish that sometimes my embarrassing meltdowns, to be honest, and also things like I wish I didn't have to deal with some comments like, oh gee, I wish I didn't have to deal with comments like, oh gee, yeah, talk slow, or like people deal with, I wish I didn't have to deal with people who want to change my voice, or...
That's their problem. That's the way I see it. I think when I spoke to the boys last week too, we talked about eye contact and the fact that, you know, a lot of people living with autism find it very hard to maintain eye contact with people, and it's not something that I push very... It's not a big thing that I push in my family with my kids. My son actually has great eye contact, whereas my daughter, not so much, but I don't push it with them because I believe that's society's problem, that they have a problem with the whole eye contact. If you don't make eye contact during a job interview, you're snaky, or, you know, you can't be trusted because, you know, you can't look someone in the eye. But that is a society problem, not so much an autism problem.
I think it's the same with inappropriate laughing, which is another thing I've struggled with.
Yeah.
And it's actually out of nervousness, like it's never out of maliciousness towards someone.
Yeah, and as I said, I think they're society's problems and not so much autism problems. So, but
I hate sometimes how the world is so reliant on body language, and I hate it when people expect me to mind read them, and I fail with that. Like, I think, come on, don't you have the patience to just say, like, say someone's busy, I'd rather them say, I don't think this is a good time, but can we offer another option to speak about it?
Yeah.
Like, I actually need to be told verbally what someone's thinking, because I'd have a limited ability to just mind read. And
so when people meet you and they realise you're on the autism spectrum, or you tell them that you're on the autism spectrum, do they automatically assume that, like, things about you, like that you're obviously a genius in your own right, but do they assume things about you that is in their head as to what autism is? Have you ever met anyone who has made false assumptions about you?
Most people in the community just accept me.
You are quite well known, though, in Bendigo. I know. Were you in the paper a few weeks ago about... have you created a visual... tell me a bit about that. You've created... Was it a visual timetable?
Bus timetable. Images of each bus stop. But going back to your first question...
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I struggle with multiple questions at once sometimes.
Yeah, sorry.
For the most part, people relate to me well. And like at church, people just see me as another person, like I don't see a trace of them thinking any differently because I'm young in what I consider to be a congregation of mainly older people. Mm. And secondly, they don't look at me differently because I have autism. Mm. Sometimes other young people say, you don't look like you have a disability because it's so hidden, particularly when I'm in a good mood. A few others will, when I'm speaking on the phone, I might not mention my autism, but I think if the person on the other end doesn't know me, or when I'm purchasing, say, train tickets, which I would like for Feline to get Mikey up and running ASAP, because I hate dealing with the ticket staff. I guess they're used to me now, but I sometimes struggle with them. Then there's, the few people who say, one guy, he said, I've got a thought I had mobility problems because I don't drive a car, and despite me not having a car, I can walk from Strathdale to Bendigo. In fact, it takes me just under 30 minutes to walk from near Strathdale Park, where I live, all the way to the Bendigo railway station.
And I
always, particularly early in the morning, when there's no buses to get me to the station, I'll still get to the station 10 minutes before the train departs.
That's awesome. I love to walk. I love it because you can take in everything around you. Do you find that's why you like walking? Is that just something that you enjoy doing? You would just enjoy going out and walking and taking in everything around you?
Particularly in our fast-paced society. I would not try the pair of shoes for the car. I do make compromises, like I do use like the bus to get around a bit when it's available, or late at night I'd get a ride with someone or use taxis. Obviously I wouldn't walk from Bendigo to Melbourne just to get to a business, to a meeting or anything, but so however I am keen to walk to Melbourne over several days, of course, one day, and raise money for something like the ASD centre you're proposing.
Yeah, well, I've actually spoken to a few people about it, and it looks like may have keyed you up with a trainer. He's a dad of a child with autism, and he's a personal trainer at a gym actually here in Strathdale. And I'm also looking at options. I have a friend who works for Adidas, but it's up to you. Like, I wanted to get you sponsored with a shoe company so they can provide you with runners and things like that, as well as gear to walk with to keep you comfortable.
Yeah.
And then also getting a sponsor involved with accommodation and food and things like that along the way. So that's something, obviously, we're looking at within the next 12 months.
Yeah.
Because I think, and I mean, how would you go about appearances on television? Is that something that would make you anxious, or is it like something like The Project or, The Today Show and, all these shows that we can promote your walk on so that we can get more people wanting to sponsor you for it? Because I think that I was blown away when you actually offered to do that for me. I just was like, wow, this is just so generous and so wonderful. I mean, to walk from Bendigo to Melbourne is a huge feat, and you think it will only take several days?
I don't care if it takes a while, like even if I walked, say, fairly short distances a day.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, it's just, as I said, I was blown away. I showed my husband and he was just like, wow, that's just amazing. So I look forward to getting that sorted.
My dad, in fact, has jokingly said in the past, oh, I reckon Daniel can walk from Bendigo to Melbourne one day.
And, you know, we're going to look at doing it. So that's something to really look forward to. So
the thing is, I'd wonder what the best route is like.
I think that's something that we'll have to sit down and work out with, because obviously we'll get a team involved with it, and we need to make sure you have a support team there too, and there'll have to be someone trailing you with a car just for, obviously safety purposes and things like that. So, we'll have to work out what the best route would be, because I think the highway might be a bit dangerous. It might be something, we need to keep you safe. And I love the idea. As long as you're up for it, I'm up for it. So,
I'm not doing it to glorify myself. But I think it would be a great opportunity to fourth eye spread the awareness of 40s to towns on the way.
I don't think it'll just spread autism to towns on the way. I think it will actually go nationwide. I think it's such a huge thing that it will, you know, I'd love to get like Australian story involved from the ABC. I mean, you know, it's such an inspirational thing that you'll be doing. It needs to sort of, everyone needs to see this and everyone needs to be aware of what you're doing and who you are, because you're a very kind person. And this is another sort of thing that gets misrepresented about autism, where, you know, there's all these misconceptions about autism, that there are no people on the spectrum don't show emotion, and people on the spectrum, you know, can never fall in love. And whereas the people who I've been meeting are the most emotionally gifted people I've ever met. They're in relationships. I've met lots of women who have children and who are married, who are on the autism spectrum, as well as men who are in relationships. And do you think that there's that special someone out there for you?
Time will tell, and yeah. I'd rather not rush this at all, because if I ever got married, I'd have to understand my wife, that my future wife would have to understand me, because as a priest said, a young priest said at a church service on Sunday, falling in love is not about feeling in love, because that dissipates over within a few years, and I'd like to avoid becoming part of the divorce and separation statistics, but if I got married, I think love is not what you feel, but a commitment to love someone, even when they're on some occasions the most irritating person.
Yeah. I've been married now, it's coming up to 5 years. I've been married 5 years, 6 years next March, and you know, my husband has his flaws, as I'm sure he'll tell you. I have my flaws, not that I'd like to think that I do, but it does. It takes a lot of work to build and maintain a strong marriage. My husband and I have been together for nearly 18 years, and we, you know, I love him as much as I did the day I sort of realised I was in love with him. And obviously the last 18 months, with having both children diagnosed within a year of one another, it has put a strain on things. But what we have done is we've worked together, and I think that's very important, is that parents of children with autism need to start working more together as opposed to separately, to not only work with their kids but work on each other as well. And that's what I found, because there is a big divorce rate in statistics for marriages that break down after a child's diagnosed with autism or any disability. And I think it's too easy to just leave a marriage. I'm not one of those people. I'm not going to leave my marriage just because it gets hard. I think people need to work at it more.
I think, yeah, I know many people, a few people on the spectrum, to live in single parent families, and sometimes, I mean, you can never blame, parents should never blame a divorce on their children, because it's not never the children's fault at all. It's because that it is because something's not right in the relationship between the husband and wife there. But I do believe that I always believe in having compassion for people who do, like, sometimes there are cases where marriages have to break up rather than to stay together and let things get worse. I mean, I'm no single parents here mentioned that the partner who does not live with the child full time would show the same respect and care that I would show him, and that sometimes the adult with autism loves both their parents equally.
Yeah. Oh, look. Now, I do want to go back to, because I want to talk about this visual bus schedule that you devised. So are Bendigo Council going forth with that? Is that something that they're moving ahead with?
It was launched towards the end of August. And
okay.
There are currently timetables for the Kangaroo Flat Bum Bus Route, and which goes via High Street the new name of St. Philanthropy?
Oh, I don't know. They've just changed it, haven't they? I'm supposed to be going there today, so I'll let you know.
I think it's called Lancel Square now. So many name changes with that since my grandfather was involved when it, as a Shire councillor for Morong, when that was first opened as Morong Village in 1979. But there's one to Kangaroo Flat.
Yep.
Then there's one to Eagle Hawk Fire, which goes past the hospital and the showgrounds, and then travels through the back parts of Eagle Hawk.
So, and they will slowly be getting those timetables out on every bus route so that...
Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent. Congratulations. That's fantastic.
People with particular disabilities can point to the bus stop they require and it can help to ease anxiety in knowing when to hop off.
Yeah.
It was targeted, more for people with intellectual disabilities, but I would have, to be honest, liked to have simplified it a bit more, or develop it as a booklet with fairly large text and what have you.
It'd be great if it could become an app for your phone too, like an application that you could put on your phone.
Yeah, unfortunately, my skills in graphic design don't extend to iPhone apps or web pages. Yeah.
So if there's anybody listening to this who would like to actually assist Daniel to get, if you do, say, like, would you be willing to work with someone if they have that capability to turn your visual bus timetables into an app for the phone? Would you be able to work with someone to help you get that started?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Of course, I created a series of social scripts last year for my honours project, which in this case it was about church life, but it can be used for, I'd like to create similar resources for catching public transport or dining out at a restaurant.
Because they're the things that sort of are quite difficult for people who live with autism. I know if we go to McDonald's, or my kids love going to Brady's Tavern, we have to sit in the same table. Heaven help us if we get there and someone's already sitting there. They actually have to move. But I think, you know, having something like that would be great. I mean, there are so many apps out there that you can create social stories. And I think, did you see Carol Gray at VAC? No, she was the second day, wasn't she, Carol? Carol does social stories in America. She's like the woman who apparently created social stories.
Well, I won't claim that they're social stories with a trademark, because I don't believe I've followed Carol Gray's criteria for a start.
But I think it's up to the individual too, because what she presents as the way that it should be written is sometimes not going to work for a lot of people. You know, there are different kids with different abilities out there that might not follow that kind of script, and that's why maybe what you're doing is a good thing. It's a new voice, and it's you're someone who lives with autism, so you know what you need. So more than likely there are going to be kids out there who would actually agree with you, because they're living with autism as well.
Yeah.
So that's something to think about. And have you ever thought about making these social scripts into, like, short films? Which are visual as well, but they're moving pictures that people can watch over and over.
My expertise isn't in video, but if anyone was interested, I'd be willing to work with them to create the video. Because I believe one of the key things about my social script was I avoided cartoon imagery, and I aimed to present a real life, more realistic look and feel, and try to create a literal interpretation of the image.
Yeah, because
actually, if anyone has contacts with, say, Metro or Feline or the public transport authorities, I would be keen to
speak with them.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to sort of talk about?
My key message is every child and every person on this earth is special, including people with ASDs. And to all the parents out there, give yourself a pat on the back for the fact that you really want the best for your children. To all the siblings, know that their patience and understanding will be rewarded, and that they credit should be given to them for the way they lived through some pretty difficult situations and with their siblings, and to the people with ISDs themselves. You don't have to do what I did to live a fulfilling life. In fact, I believe strongly that just as I've been to uni and what have you, does not make me a better person, nor does having intelligence make you the best person in the world, but neither that by doing your best and even reaching your full potential, whether it even be TAFE or stacking supermarket shelves, like, they're all important jobs at the end of the day. Like, if we didn't have them, the world would go into chaos. But know that every person's important, not because of their status in society or the fact that they're intellectual or so-called gifted, because everybody's gifted, but every person special because of who they are.
Have you done any sort of training in regards to getting up there? And I mean, because I know that there'd be a lot of people who'd be interested in listening to you and listening to your story. Would that make you feel anxious if you had to stand up in front of 150, 200 people to talk?
I've done it for years.
Oh, have you? Oh.
At schools, university and school students.
Have you thought about putting a submission in for the big conference next year in Adelaide?
Amanda Golding's thinking of me co-presenting with someone else. An autism conference is not complete without the input of people on the spectrum.
Okay, well, that was Daniel Giles, part two of our wonderful interview with Daniel, and I hope that you all enjoyed that.
Well, that's all for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be back next week with more Real People Talk Autism. Until then, take care and goodbye.